Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Branching off of the Napoleonic Wars, very famous book, War and Peace, by Leo Tolstoy. It was a literary work that changed and affected people and culture in a huge way. How do you exactly think War and Peace came to influence the modern zeitgeist and how we view human conflicts today? Or did it?
No, it did. I mean, because if there is one important kind of narrative or theme that you see in Tolstoy's writing, is it's the role of individual in history, and then that's important, right? In terms of what I do, how we perceive as on a professional level, or when you read the book or when you contemplate your own place, is that what's your agency? That's really the fundamental question that Tolstoy asks in War and Peace. What's the agency of individuals? And that can be seen through Tolstoy's creation of character of Napoleon, of Andrei Bolkonsky, of course, or Pierre Bezukhov, right? And Kutuzov, too. All of them are kind of protagonists of War and Peace. And if you read with that point of view, right, you see that what Tolstoy is doing is essentially he removes the agency of an individual. Napoleon, yes, brilliant, yes, god of war, yes, he does all of this. But ultimately, as Kutuzov kind of puts it, ultimately, it's all futile. Right? This agent, you know, he wants to control armies, he wants to control individual soldiers on the battlefield, but ultimately, it comes to naught. And then he kind of counterpoint to it is Kutuzov, yeah, at the Battle of Borodino, where instead of being like Napoleon, trying to send troops here and there and kind of taking direct control of the battle, Kutuzov, in Kutuzov's famous description, sits there near the hill at Gorky and eats fried chicken.
Right. That's what I would do.
All right. Yeah. I don't know what your favorite is. We have canes, and nothing beats canes. So in that sense, I think this is where War and Peace is really a masterful philosophical novel. It's kind of what asks you to contemplate the agency. And Bolkonsky, right, starts by aspiring to be like Napoleon. He starts by wanting to be a man of action and ultimately kind of becomes like Kutuzov, man of contemplation and less of kind of agency in large historical narratives. Tolstoy believes that there is this grand narratives of history, and that we are caught in these narratives, and then and that we don't have that much of an agency to change them.
It's a very modern view of history. I think Tolstoy, Tolstoy would definitely be he'd be interested. I think it'd be interesting to have a conversation with him about what's going on today and see if he agrees or disagrees with the common movements about history or against history, or it would be interesting.
Absolutely, I think so. The next best thing would be to look at, there's a wonderful recent book called Tolstoy on War. And that book, I think edited by Rick McPeak and Donna Orwin, actually tried to grapple with Tolstoy's use of history and philosophy, right? His kind of, and not just in War and Peace, but more broadly in his narrative, because of course, you've written extensively, and whether you look at Anna Karenina, right, Haji Murad, or others, right, that role of a human in history is actually one of the fascinating themes for Tolstoy.
So a lot of the discourse surrounding the Napoleonic Wars is based around the man himself. There seems to be two camps of thought. Either he was a bloodthirsty butcher who, sought power at every turn, or he was a reformer who did was what was necessary, and every single time he tried to search for peace. What's your opinion on the man?
Well, how much time do we have? there is much that can be said, and I'll tell you this, and I'm first to admit, and I certainly mention it in my book on Napoleonic Wars, and in the preface, that I came to Napoleon because I was kind of enticed, lured by the romantic figure that he presents, this strikes. There's a lot that you can say about Napoleon as a reformer. There's a lot that we can say about Napoleon as a man who really lays the foundation for modern France, a man who brought, who was the catalyst for spreading modernity in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He's the man, of course, responsible for example, Bank of France, complete reorganization of the educational system, restructuring of property assessment in France and the territories France controlled at the time. We can talk about his legal reforms, right, and so on and so on. If nothing else, right, maybe it's a post-pandemic me, but if nothing else, Napoleon is the first one to engage in mass vaccination campaigns. Mm. So national-level vaccination campaigns, right, where he kind of encourage people to literally send out groups of people, right, the doctors and all, to convince regular folk to get vaccinated for smallpox. Right? So there's a lot of things that he did that I think it's hard to deny that was a good thing. But then, of course, you get up close, right, and you see that the kind of the jagged angles of him, where he's ruthless. He more often than not is willing to use force to get his way. We know that he effectively creates a mass, I would say, first modern surveillance state. Yes, other countries have police systems. Of course, any state must have some enforcement mechanism and police is in. But Napoleon creates what we can kind of what we experience, kind of surveillance, where Napoleon, for example, has a police system that reports from every town, every city. There is nonstop stream of information. What are people thinking? What are they saying? What are they behaving? There's volumes and volumes of this information that come to him, then being digested, and he receives these weekly memos of what people are saying in the streets, because the police agents stand there in civilian clothing and kind of gather this information. The mass police network that of agents that he creates is absolutely, you know, remarkable, something kind of on the scale of East Germany and then the Cold War, not to mention the Soviets. I mean, it's really stunning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what is the problem. The problem, of course, is he's willing to trample on constitutional system. So oftentimes people forget that French Empire had the constitution, but we forget about it because very rarely did it matter when it came to Napoleon getting his way. And of course, he was oftentimes a ruthless opportunist. So how do we reconcile, right? Or should we reconcile? So my approach is we just need to deal with him the way he is. We need to talk about his positive reforms and see the legacy that he left behind. But at the same time, bear in mind that he was a callous, ruthless opportunist. Who was responsible for death of thousands of people?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's really hard grappling with the idea of empire, especially in the modern day. I mean, there's the idea of the Pax Britannica and the Pax Mongolica, the Pax Romanica. These are periods of supposed intense peace and prosperity, and in one aspect, sure, there was that, but at the other, like you were saying, there was intense security, there was intense violence, there was intense control, and it just goes to show the sort of mechanisms that empires need to even function. I mean, the same thing you're saying about Napoleon could be said about, I don't know, George Bush. It could be said about it could be said about any number of people throughout history who dealt with the same things, tried to reform a system, and eventually failed. I mean, you mentioned the Soviet Union. Well, at some times they were incredibly callous, and they were a police state. They also managed a massive vaccination campaign, like you're talking about. They managed to get rid of plenty of illiteracy in the countryside, but at the same time, they were still the Soviet Union who sent political dissidents to the middle of Siberia.
No, absolutely. I mean, look at China today, right? We know that China in the last 30 years lifted more people out of poverty than any society previously.
Wow.
But at what price, right? I have absolute admiration for Chinese history and the sophisticated culture, and but I would not want to live in China nowadays, right? Same applies for Russia, right? Russian history is rich, very interesting. Russian culture is quite complex and rich. But I wouldn't want to, I don't want to actually not simply live. I don't want to even visit Russia. So one of the reasons why I'm essentially moving away from Russian history and towards kind of new and greener fields is because I know that in order for me to stay active in the field of Russian history, I need to have access to archives, and that's not going to happen anytime soon. So this is essentially to say that I think we both agree that we need to really value the intricacy of the past,
definitely,
the complexity of it, and deal with it rather than to simply run away from it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with you 100% there.
I think one of the, you know, if we can stay on this topic,
yeah, for sure, second, yeah, yeah,
like, not, you know, not to, you know, beat the dead horse, but you know, I'm a Georgian, so I go to Georgia often enough. And what one of the fundamental problems I see, especially in the small countries, small nations like Georgia, and same can be said about Serbia, Poland, you can smaller nations, is they all are grappling with how to craft their national narratives. History plays a crucial role in crafting a national narrative, right? History is the way we make sense who we are, where we come from, what we are about, and where we're heading as a nation, right? As a group of people who are united by some common bonds, and however you want to define it, language, right, religion, culture, land, whatever. And so that, for example, is one of the crucial things about Georgian current struggles in Georgia over control of history. Who writes history? How we write history? What should be the focus of it? So I've spent summer there, and I know that, you know, history in Georgia is weaponized, and that's not something, again, we can say that, as you pointed out, in many other countries, but it feels certainly weaponized to a far greater degree than other countries, because my next project is about Caucasus, and the guy at the topic that I'm working on is deals with the period when Russian takeover of Caucasus takes place. Mm-hmm. So how are we supposed to deal with that takeover? Is it a new imperial entity coming in and taking over and bringing the fruits of civilization, right? or is this yet another empire coming in and delaying our development, our growth, right? Mm-hmm. So as you follow Georgian politics right now, and they have elections coming up in October. It's volatile, you know, really politically volatile election cycle, and history plays a crucial role. Almost every week, there is this historical debate about the history, debate about interpretation of history. I think it is absolutely important to get it right. The question is, how do we do it, right? And that's, I don't have a good answer to it, except to say that I'm not about sugarcoating history. Let's deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Yes. And it's especially prevalent for you, like you were saying, history to someone who's Georgian is so close to them. It's not some far off thing where, oh, that happened only 200, people say that in America all the time. Oh, it happened 100 years ago. What? Who cares? It's still affecting us today. Just like, you know, Russian takeover of Georgia might have happened 700 years ago, but it's still affecting your people today, and it's affecting them in a real serious way, and it affected you personally.
Yes, and I mean, you know, I'm Georgian American, so I'm Absolute passion for American history, and always kills me when students come to my classes, and they would say, actually, you'll be surprised how many of them say that American history is boring. It's anything but boring to me, and I say that as an outsider who've kind of dealt with European and Middle Eastern history, but to me, American history is absolutely fascinating. Yes, maybe not as long as, let's say, Armenian history, right? That goes back 5, 6,000 years. But in those 250 years, Americans were able to cram so much, right? So much. And I love exploring that. Just actually 2 days ago, I gave a talk at Smithsonian on Lafayette. Right? Lafayette is a hero of two worlds and kind of this kind of a man who both can be used as a kind of point of entry into the American Revolutionary era, but also a point of entry into the French Revolutionary era. And both of them are absolutely fascinating to explore. But what bothers me is kind of maybe in recent years, this desire to sanitize kind of, let's say, American Revolutionary era or especially 19th century American history. No, no country is an angelic country. We all have our good and bad development, good and bad things that happened. We need to accept it and, more crucially, analyze and make sense of them.
So going back to the Napoleonic Wars, undoubtedly one of the biggest mistakes Napoleon made was his decision to overthrow the monarchy of Spain. In your opinion, what were some of the biggest mistakes the Allies made that prolonged the war?
The Allies, that's a good question. Not the question that you usually get. Usually, like, how many mistakes Napoleon made? From the Allies' point of view, I think I would say one of the main ones is not learning lessons fast enough. So Austrians, for example, could have gotten their act together and started kind of reforming and changing and improving much earlier than they have. In 1804, 1805, some Austrian officers like Archduke Charles are advocating reforms. They are kind of pointing out, hey, we've already lost two wars against French. Maybe it's time for us to reform. And they are outshouted, out kind of gunned, and ultimately reform fails. And it's only after Napoleon shows up yet again and wipes his feet at the Austrians that the Austrians did realize, yes, we need to start reforming. Same applies for the Russians, right? Same applies for the Prussians, kind of learning the lessons of it. And then maybe it's easy for me to say because I have a benefit of a hindsight, right? They certainly believe that they will be able to maybe deal with Napoleon just one more time. That's one. Second, I think is kind of is a coalition fighting. If we look at why coalitions failed until 1813, is that they consistently failed to coordinate well. And then Napoleon was the beneficiary of the fact that the coalition might look enormous on the paper, but those in participating countries acted kind of in their own interests, in their self-interest. For example, Prussians in 1805 could have supported the Third Coalition, could have entered the war, and history would have been dramatically different, absolutely different. As it was, Prussians dragged their feet, didn't join the Third Coalition, send their foreign minister to talk, and that guy shows up the day of the Battle of Austerlitz. Coalition is crushed, it's wiped out. Imagine what would have happened if Prussians have joined and brought 180,000 men, let's say in October or November, because that's what Russians and Austrians were telling them to do, right? Do it, right? Let's join, let's do it together. And Prussians kind of drag their feet. So same applies for the British. For example, one of the frustrations from the continental point of view, especially Austrian and Russian point of view of Britain, is that British oftentimes appear self-serving. And I think good example of this would be 1801 and then 1807, when Britain, kind of on the spur of a moment, go and bomb Danish capital, Copenhagen. And yet, when the Allies need their help, it's like weeks in coming, right? So you can't organize an expedition in 1807 to Copenhagen and bomb it in 2 weeks, but you can't help us. You come up with all these excuses, right? So I think it's kind of multiple kind of factors here over the span of the period. Some of it was them underestimating the threat Napoleon posed. Some of it putting their own personal needs, kind of national, what you know we will call today national interests over kind of coalition interests. But they ultimately learn, and that's the key reason why they win.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Napoleon loses in 1813 is that he's not facing the same coalition as before. He's facing a coalition that has reformed its troops. He faces a coalition where the troops all are in the field at the same time. So he's facing Russians, Austrians, and Russians all at the same time. Plus, don't forget the Swedes. I don't want to get your Swedish listeners upset.
Don't want to piss them off.
So, yeah, we know the lobbies.
Don't want to piss them lobbies. Off.
Yeah, the Bernadotteian lobby. You never know. And so Napoleon is facing a different type and different nature of a coalition, and he can't really deal with it the same way he dealt in previous years.
And to dovetail off that, he's basically facing like the same French army times five, because the Allies did a pretty good job of you know siphoning off French tactics and strategy and sort of pasting it onto their own you know armed forces. Is that correct to say?
That's true.
Hmm.
That's true. And to when it comes to let's say military organization,
yeah,
right. Hmm. They all have. So here's what, again, Austrians and Prussians, Russians were, they had sophisticated military forces, some of the best from the kind of pre-revolutionary era. And they fought each other in 7 Years' War and War of Austrian Succession. Oh. And there was a mixed success. And I do want to make sure to point out that there is a reason why French Revolutionary Wars lasted a decade. Right? It's not like French invented something and then went and steamrolled. Or everyone else. I mean, they fought from 1792 until 1802, and more often than not, and especially in places like Rhineland, the old regime armies held their ground against the new French army. I think Napoleon brings something unique to this system, and that is systematizing it, cherry kind of picking the best practices, creating an efficient meritocratic system, and those are the ingredients then Prussians borrow in 1807, then Russians borrow some parts of it in 1806, Austrians borrow in 1809. Now they can copy paste everything, so this is important to bear in mind. They are not, for example, engaging in national mobilization to the level that France does, because inherently French society is in a different position than Russian or Austrian society. But they try to come to borrow as much of military change as they can feel comfortable with, and certainly on administrative and command level they do, and that enhances their military capacity. So in 1805 Napoleon is facing Austrians and Russians who are operating in ad hoc divisions, in 1813 he's facing permanent corps with permanent divisions with a permanent structure attached to them. And so it's a much, much different force to deal with.
So speaking of Napoleon, was there any realistic way where he could have retained the title of sovereign of France without, you know, I guess in his mind, sacrificing his honor, whatever that means?
Plenty. Hmm. That's where I take an issue with some of my colleagues who are a little bit too pro-Napoleon and gonna no, he could have. Now, we know that Napoleon himself believed, or at least he wrote, not sure how deep that belief was, he believed that if he lost the war, the people of France will not follow him. That he believed that his regime was inherently in power because of his success on battlefield. But everything points to that not being the case. So in 1813, so after Napoleon is defeated in Russia, he goes to France, raises a new army, comes back, and the two sides kind of fight again in May for control of what is today Eastern Germany and Poland. And Napoleon wins. He wins massive battles at Lutzen, at Bautzen, and then the two sides agree to have an armistice, right? Let's talk. And that, to me, is one of the crucial moments, especially for Napoleon, because he agrees to negotiate with really half-heartedly. His heart is not really negotiations, because he believes he just came out of the streak of victories. He just needs a couple more and he will win. But this was a missed opportunity, because if we look at the terms that was offered him, they were harsh, but I think reasonable, right? France would still be an empire, but not the empire it used to be. And I think if you lose a war on a scale that like Napoleon did in Russia, there has to be an expectation that you would have to compromise, except Napoleon refuses to do inflation. And this is why I think if he had lost those two battles, or at least lost one battle, maybe in his mind he would have been more open to negotiation. As it was, they offered to give up Poland, they offered to give up parts of Italy. He bristles at that, because he believes this is way too much, that he's ready to fight, that he has just won those battles, and that he can deal with the enemy. Well, he can't, right? He's ultimately defeated. But here's another interesting thing. In 1814, in January of 1814, the Allies again make him an offer, and would have been, again, it was a good offer. Yes, France would have lost most of its imperial possessions, but Napoleon would have been still sovereign of France, and he refuses it. They have a whole congress at Châtillon to discuss that. And ultimately, Napoleon essentially is late in giving the final answer. Congress fails, and then the war continues. And that is why when Napoleon does come back from Elba in 1815, the great powers, the people who fought with him and who tried to negotiate with him, are not really taking his assurances that he has changed seriously. Right? Napoleon in 1815 tries to convince everyone that, hey, I've changed. I'm not going to mess around anymore. I just want to be ruler of France. But that's the same guy who walked away from negotiations on at least a couple of occasions. Yes, Napoleon, there are many factors why Napoleon ultimately lost, but I think one of the crucial factors is he himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was the stance, we're talking a little bit now later in the war, the stance that Russia had prior to the 1812 invasion, was it one of true Francophilia, where the emperor and the Russian Tsar were, you know, best buds, shaking hands, kissing babies, etc.? Or was it one of, you know, I'm going to bide my time until the moment's right? Because the whole time they were still accepting food and grain from Great Britain at the expense of the French, which they were supposed to have their, you know, continental system, but the Russians refused every time to apply to those rules.
Well, I mean, don't be too harsh on Russians in that sense, because it was not in their self-interest to abide by the continental system, nor it was their willing choice to join it. The history of Russian, kind of Russian-French or Franco-Russian relations is quite complex and goes way back. But if you look at the 18th century alone, then you'll see that more often than not, France tried its best to constrain Russia. So you mentioned Charles, right? Well, if you look at the history of Sweden, you'll know that France was providing support to Swedes in order to constrain Russian expansion in the north. Of course, during the Wars of Polish Succession, the first half of the 18th century, France was keen on supporting Poland for that same reason, right? Ultimately, right, we know that the French king's wife was Polish. When her father lost the throne, he ultimately comes, you know, to France and lives. So there are ways that France tried to kind of position itself to constrain Russian expansion, unsuccessful. Right, Poland is destroyed, French efforts to prop up and help Ottomans in relationship with Russians ultimately fail, and Russians consistently come out on top and effectively grab a growing share of Ottoman territories. As when we get to the Napoleonic period, there is only one brief period, moment, when there is a rapprochement, kind of a good relationship between France and Russia, and that is between 1799 and 1801. And that's a period of Emperor Paul's reign. And the primary reason why France and Russia kind of like each other is because they hate British. And there's a sense in Russia, not to mention in France, that Britain has its dirty hand in all the intrigues. Emperor Paul is really pissed off at how British treated him during the War of Second Coalition. He's upset that, from his point of view, Austrians and British used Russian soldiers to gain their goals, their national objectives, essentially through, you know, shedding Russian blood. So in 1799, he famously recalls his army from Italy, recalls his troops from Switzerland, and makes a massive U-turn from being anti-French to being anti-British, to the degree that in 1800, Russia and France form an anti-British League of Armed Neutrality, right? Essentially creating this first continental system that is designed to protect Europe from British. But that only lasted until March of 1801, when Paul conveniently is assassinated. Now, Bonaparte was absolutely convinced that Britain was involved in it, and there's some evidence for it. The British ambassador to Russia was involved in this. But the key outcome of it is that Paul's successor, his son Alexander, makes him, again, turns a Russian foreign policy in the opposite direction, from being pro-French and anti-British to initially ostensibly neutral, but increasingly anti-French. I can rationalize why Alexander did so, because from his point of view, French aggrandizement, it was not in Russian interest. France's expansion into Central Europe, where Russians had historical connections to local German princely houses, was not in the interest of Russia. And so, by 1805, Russia is willing to make a kind of stance, confront France, and they fail. And so they consistently then fail until 1807, when they can no longer endure this series of defeats at the hands of Napoleon, then they have to negotiate with him. But this is not a negotiation of, I would say, two equals. Napoleon goes out of his way to pretend that Russia and France are equal, but the reality is France is way more dominant than Russia is, to the degree that Russians have to join a French economic model, French economic warfare against Britain. But that's not in the Russian interests. And so Russians try to accommodate French, but by 1812, it's clear that the continental system is harmful to the Russian economic and political interests. And so they make a rational choice to get out.
Yeah. So of all the, I guess, side figures that you write about throughout the Napoleonic Wars of global history, my personal favorite is Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary and the first president of the island. Who are some of your favorite side characters, if I could use the term, from the era? And if you could, who would you bring home for dinner?
That's great. Oh, there are so many. Oh boy, where to start? Toussaint, I think I would love to spend an evening with Toussaint. There's a wonderful new biography of Toussaint Louverture by Soutry Nazar, and it's brilliant. Kind of, we see him in all complexity, right? Again, Haitian Revolution is a good example where you can absolutely relate to the cause of these slaves fighting for freedom, but then also understand how the revolution went way different way after 1804, and the excesses committed after 1804 can also turn you off from this cause. I actually kind of, there's a guy that I'm working on. I have a poster right here. One of my side projects is a graphic history
Oh, wow.
So it's essentially a hardcore history, like regular history, but
Yeah.
in a graphic genre.
That's cool.
And
Yeah.
I write, and actually I'll show you, here's one of the scenes. And I know your listeners probably will not be able to see it, but you'll get a kick out of it, right? So
Oh,
here's
that's really cool. Yeah, I've actually read a few of these about the Mughal Empire. There's like a whole series about the Mughal Empire based around like where it's a graphic novel and it's in the same stylized
based on
version you
history.
are.
So it's not,
Yeah.
it's, yeah, it's not fictional. There's a by nature of it, there's a lot of interpretation, but not fiction. So I would love to hang out with this guy, because this guy, the protagonist that I'm writing on, happens to be from my hometown, from Tbilisi. Was captured, sold into slavery in Istanbul, then from Istanbul was sold into slavery again in Egypt, became a Mamluk. Then French showed up, and I guess the guy liked the notions of equality and liberty and fraternity, so he switched side, joined the French army, and then with the French army he campaigned all across Europe.
Wow.
So every campaign Napoleon fought, this guy was there, and just following in his footsteps. Man, unfortunately he didn't write memoir, and so that's a problem. But kind of following in his footsteps, it would have been one hell of a journey, and he survived it. He survived
Wow.
with over 45 wounds, right? Sometimes people in the Napoleonic field oohing and eyeing about Marshal Oudinot with his 23 injuries. This guy is over 40, 40 more, 45 to be precise, including 23 injuries that he sustained in a single battle. So I would love to hang out with him,
This is
and
basically the
including that he
George and
would have
Chuck Norris.
that will be a subtitle.
That maybe I'll just name the show the George and Chuck Norris.
But I have several kind of projects like this where I look at the people that more to the kind of stand by the curtains of history, so to
Yeah.
speak, right? Not out on the scene, but doing them. So this is one. Now this one is unique because he is, I would say, the voiceless of the history, because he wrote no memoirs. He wrote very, very, very few letters. Or at least he might have written a lot to his wife, but unfortunately, not much survived. And so the challenge, therefore, is to reconstruct his life, because, as I said, microhistorical approach like this offers you a window, a snapshot of history, and from a different angle that might let you kind of ask your question. Well, what did the revolution mean to a Georgian guy who was born in a small village, kidnapped, sold into slavery, forced to accept Islam, become a military slave, and then freed, reconverted to Christianity, right? So what is his identity? What is, when he's standing there, and he is in 1804, and he pledges an oath, a remarkable oath, both to the empire, well, to, no, let me paraphrase, both to the emperor and to the republic. What did it mean to him? Those are the questions I want to ask. Another guy I'm writing is the guy who actually is one of the financiers, right? We all talk about Napoleonic Wars, but somebody had to pay for them, right? Oh, these wars cost a lot of money. Soldiers needed ammunition, shoes, pantalons, right? Muskets. How was all this procured? Who paid for all this? Well, I'm looking at the guy who plays an absolutely central role in creating a contractor state. That's essentially what I'm arguing. A financial contractor state that underpins Napoleonic era. He has a massive chain of suppliers, and essentially Napoleon can pick up a proverbial phone, right? Give him a call and say, "Hey, listen, I need this many shoes, this many pantaloons right there. Can you do it?" And so I would, I'm kind of writing a biography of his. So I would love to sit with him, because that guy is absolutely remarkable. Starts as nobody, son of a small kind of provincial businessman, and then becomes one of the wealthiest men in Europe, certainly in France, probably in Europe, and competes with the likes of Rothschilds. So yeah, I would love to hang out with him and attend one of his notorious parties. That would have been awesome. So maybe I should join him rather than he join me, right? Because I don't think I can throw the party like he did.
I can only imagine. So, finishing up for today, this is a history podcast, so everyone's waiting for me to ask about historical what ifs, obviously. What if Napoleon's victory on the Berezina was not the so-called barren one that you call it in your book? What if it was all-encompassing? Would the Grand Army continue to thrive, or would it have not really mattered one way or the other?
No, they're not at Berezina. Berezina, technically, it is a victory in that Napoleon and most of his army escapes. But even if he had inflicted a crushing defeat on the Russians, it would not have mattered because Berezina takes place in November. By that time, Napoleon already lost two-thirds of his army. By the flip, I think better will be if you flip that and we go maybe 3 months earlier and we go to, no, well, yeah, three. Probably July, so July of 1812. The war began between Russia and France on June 23rd, 24th, right? So invasion begins. So if we fast forward 2 weeks into war, and let's say Napoleon caught Russians in the borderland, just like, for example, Russian commander Bagration, Peter Bagration, another Georgian who commanded a massive Russian army, he wanted to confront Napoleon. And let's say people they listened to him and they fought Napoleon somewhere around Vilna, Napoleon would have absolutely crushed them. That is an interesting proposition. And the question I would have kind of I often contemplated was, well, what would have happened next? Right? Let's say if Russian army is crushed, what next? Well, I'm writing a book right now, kind of a new history of this war, and my guess, gut feeling is knowing what Alexander was discussing in secret with his advisors, that the war will have continued. He would have tried to rebuild the army, and it would not have followed the same way as it did. But I think Russians would have resisted because I cannot see a scenario in which Emperor Alexander in 1812 kind of kowtows to Napoleon. Now, let me ask you a different maybe what if, right? Because that essentially is a war, and then it's a war of attrition, we'll see. The bigger question is why Napoleon decided to go to Russia?
That's a good
And I don't
question.
see the need for it in 1812. I absolutely don't. What I would see, what I would argue, and one of these great what ifs. So here's Napoleon. He has an army of almost a million men in 1812, well, 1811, right? First half of 1812. He has some 686,000 soldiers lined up for invasion of Russia. Well, what if I leave, what if he left quarter of them, let's say 200,000 to watch the Russians? I would say third, all right, third of them, and then taking the rest of it down to peninsula to settle once and for all the problem with the British, with the Spanish, with the Portuguese. Because the way I see that 1812, if Napoleon had returned to Spain, would have had a repetition of Napoleon's invasion of Spain in 1808, when he simply mopped up floor with the Spanish armies. We've seen what happened to the British; they're chased out of the peninsula. That is an interesting proposition. Like, all right, so he chases them out. Then what? Right. So this is where, again, ultimately, all of these what-if scenarios should lead us to this question: what will ultimately Napoleon have done? Because, and that's one of the key points I'm making in the Napoleonic Wars book, by 1810, 1811, especially by 1812, Napoleon had lost the global war. Napoleon's colonial empire is erased. He has no possessions in America, no possessions in the Caribbean. He lost South Africa. He lost India. He lost Indonesia in 1811. He lost Mascarene Islands. That's it. The global war is lost. What the way I view is that in 1812, the best he can hope is to win the regional war in Europe, and then maybe start building his capacity up, reach certain parity with Britain, and maybe come to an agreement. Now that's beyond 1815, right? That we talk about 1820s. By that time, if Napoleon's cancer would have developed the way it did, he would have been dead by 1821. So who knows how things would have turned out?
Yeah, there's only a few years left at that point. I mean, you got 6 years
Exactly. He doesn't
of
know
governorship.
Yeah, he doesn't know it.
What was the justification for invading Russia basically like they're gonna invade us soon, so we have to do it right now before they get too powerful? Is that what sort of
No, because Napoleon knew that Russians were not in position to invade him. We know that Russians in 1810, 1811 explored a possibility of launching what they call preemptive strike. They had troops in the borderland. They had this core, kind of the beginning of the kernels of what will become those three armies. And they considered invading what was Poland or Duchy of Warsaw. And then one of the plans was let's rush as fast as possible towards the Elbe and then incite German uprisings. But they understood that they themselves would not be able to do it, that they need help. And so they reached out to Prussians secretly and they reached out to Austrians. And both of those countries told them, "Are you freaking insane? The last thing we need is Napoleon getting pissed off, bringing his big club out and beating the crap out of all of us." And so, with the loss of Prussian and Austrian support, Russians were absolutely in no position to wage an offensive war. And that's where why I'm arguing is that Napoleon should have dealt with the Russians more diplomatically. Just like, I think you alluded to this, he should have dealt Spanish issue diplomatically rather than forcefully. He could have, for example, responded to the Spanish king, the future King Ferdinand's appeals, and said, "Hey, Ferdinand, I hear you want to marry one of my relatives. Sure, here's one, marry, but my condition is she's gonna come with advisors," quote unquote, and then effectively control maybe French, Spanish politics through your French advisors. But that's not what happened, right? I think what we see here is him becoming a victim of his own success. And it's his unprecedented level of success, right? 1805, 1806, 1807. It's a streak of successes unlike anything, really. And I part of me understands why Napoleon decides to invade Spain in 1808 because he believes that he continues this streak, he can deal with it. And part of me tries to rationalize why he went into Russia in 1812 because he was convinced that the war will be short. Right? He at no point did he envision that war lasting more than 4 to 6 weeks. And then, of course, no one goes to war expecting to lose. So, but I think he should have, knowing who he was, this is what surprises me essentially. Knowing who he was, having read his correspondence, I was involved in this remarkable project to publish a new version of Napoleonic correspondence. And we've published 15 volumes and 40 plus thousand letters. And if you read all these letters and you've, there's, it is impossible to walk away from that set without a certain level of admiration for this man. And yet, then you look at history and you see him making these mistakes. And you realize that even smart men, genius level kind of men, are prone to enormous mistakes.
So you've mentioned at least 15 separate things you're working on in this interview. You're truly a man for all seasons. But could you go into a little bit more detail on some of the projects you're working on? You've mentioned the graphic novel. You've mentioned several other books. What other stuff are you got your hands in?
I'm one of those people who like to have kind of multiple little fires going on, right? You can put little kind of coals here and there. And I think partly because as you're working on one project and you're researching, you find so many remarkable kind of nuggets here and there that you're like, "Ooh, look at this. That's going to be a great idea." I keep some for my students. So some students will come and they'll like, "I don't know what to work on." I'll like, "Listen, here's the nugget, right? Go polish, pursue it." And some of it I know that will be more challenging for students and I think deserve a more substantive treatment. So The book that I'm working on right now, kind of where it takes up most of my attention, is the New History of Louisiana Purchase, but looking at Louisiana Purchase from wider international geopolitical level, kind of understanding it not as an American experience, but understanding it as an ex from a French imperial point perspective, Spanish imperial perspective, British imperial perspective,
Wow.
kind of trying to tie in the Native American perspective, right? What was the Louisiana, in many respects, Louisiana purchases, right? Because there are multiple kind of perceptions of it. That's my big one. I'm about halfway through it, and hopefully we'll finish it soon enough.
That's a fantastic
My
idea
other
for a book,
project,
by the way.
yeah, thank you, thank you, thank you. My other project is the one that I alluded. I want to essentially write, I would say, this financial economic history of Napoleonic Wars. I would not be able to write simply the comprehensive history because no one person, I think, will be able to do it. But I can do it through that micro historical approach. If I look at the key figure, because he's so interconnected, that I might be able to showcase the financial history of Napoleonic Wars by studying this crucial financier. And then I have smaller projects like I want to write, this graphic novella about this band of misfits from Georgia that of course rampage across Europe. I want to write a history of Caucasus that is not as well known, and I think deserves to be better studied and better known because it's a fascinating period, fascinating region, very complex, and there's a lot of things we can learn about modern day Caucasus and its role in international relationship by looking in over the past 200 years.
Yeah, and things in the Caucasus, if you wouldn't mind talking about that for a second, are they're definitely in a very volatile state, as you mentioned before. There was the Azerbaijan, Armenia had a very short conflict a year or so ago about a contested region, which has been contested since Stalin was alive, mostly because of Stalin's handiwork. Do you see like a way moving forward for the region where it isn't getting like pushed and pulled by either some Russian faction and then like an Iranian faction, a Turkish faction? Is there any way that they can find some stability interregionally?
No, and this is where that Fukuyama's the end of history kind of nonsense. No, this is, if anything, Caucasus is a good example of the vengeance of history. Is that Caucasus finds itself, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan finds themselves right now, in many respects, like they were, and I'm to me, like they were in back in 16th century when the Ottomans and the Iranians were signing Treaty of Amasya and splitting Caucasus in spheres of influence, right? Or like they were back in 19th century when Russians, Ottomans, and Iranians were fighting for the kind of food, their own spheres of influence here. So, this is the region that will be a focal point of great power politics. And not just Russians, Iranians, and Turks. China is a huge power player there. The vast investments Chinese have made in the region. I've just came back from region, and then I've traveled all, some almost 4,000 miles across the region, and there are a lot of highways that are built by Chinese with a Chinese investment. So of course that's part of that larger kind of global scheme that Chinese have, and of course Americans are involved, intricately involved in this region. So I don't see how these countries will be able to really figure it out without first settling the issue of what they want really to accomplish. Because here we are, and I'm not going to touch the Northern Caucasus. Northern Caucasus is an entirely kind of huge subject to explore itself. But in South Caucasus, we have effectively Azerbaijan with a virtual dictatorship. We have Georgia with a virtual oligarchy led by an oligarch. And we have Armenia, which is in a weird kind of presidential republic, which, as you probably seen 2 days ago, announced that it prevented a Russian coup that was designed to overthrow its government. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. The region is small, but it is extremely complex, intertwined destinies,
and resource rich. That's one of the main reasons why.
And interconnected. Armenian future is connected to Azerbaijan, is just as Georgian's future is connected to Azerbaijan's, and Azerbaijan's future is connected to both. So, in ideal world, the three connected people will sit down and kind of figure out their own future. But as it is, there is so much, I think it's animosity between the three sides that I find it hard that, I find it hard to foresee that anytime in the future this will be resolved. So we'll see how the Georgian elections in October play out. But I'm hopeful that the Georgian aspirations for Western integration will be fulfilled, that people will actually speak their mind, and that the new government will be more willing to seek integration in European Union rather than seek integration with Russia.
No, that's a great way to end it on a hopeful note there. Before we end up today, where can people find some of your work? Either your social media, website, your place to buy your books.
Anyone is welcome to send me an email. I'm always excited to hear from people. If you have questions, if you have a good book to recommend, I'm always on the hunt for one. If you search my last name, the first result will be my university address with an email. I'm active on Twitter and social and Facebook. My books are sold anywhere good books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, both in-house, in a brick-and-mortar store, but also more crucially online. And my hope is I'll be done with the Louisiana Purchase in the next 6 months, and it will come out next year.
I would love to read that. And I will do, if you allow me to, I would love to do an episode on your Louisiana Purchase book. I think that would be incredible.
Thank you. It would be an honor.
For me as well. And he's right. He will respond to basically anyone's email. He responded to mine. So,
Listen, I get emails from elementary school. No, I wouldn't say, I get one elementary school, but I have quite a few middle and high school students who are keen on history, and they somehow find something written by me, and they shoot me an email saying, "Hey, I got a project. Can you help me?" I'm like, tell me what you need. because the role of a professor, on the last point, not to overstay my welcome, but the role of a historian, a social professional, history professor, is not to sit in an ivory tower, but to engage people, to share the passion for history, to facilitate their quest. Everyone, we are here for only a short period of time, and we all try to make sense of this time. And my hope is that as we're making sense of why we're here, that we've tried to make it in a broader context. And that's where I come. Or people like me come, where we help you really place yourself, your experience, in a wider set of human experiences. History is cool. Go read and enjoy it.
That was really beautiful. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support, and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.